Originally, the deal delivered in May of 2024. I think that the big news is, as you mentioned, you know, Sonder, the long term stay platform filed for bankruptcy in Q4 of last year. They officially filed for Chapter 7 in November. They leased 94 units from us at the project under a kind of master lease structure, so with a five-year term. With their filing of bankruptcy, they have effectively vacated the building. I think it is of note, you know, this was the ultimate decision to file for bankruptcy at Sonder was not specifically, you know, due to any performance issues at this location. So we actually kind of, from a business plan standpoint, the we were performing well in our Sonder units. I think kind of historic average occupancy was somewhere around 92% for those units. So we've done well in terms of uptake and utilization as it related to the business concept. Sonder had formed a partnership with Marriott. Marriott was providing a substantial kind of liquidity to the business, and I think just across the country, I think they've grown rather quickly, and you know the investments they made had not materialized as designed. So, as it relates to kind of our current plans, we evaluated the prospect of kind of bringing in another short-term rental platform to step into the space. If you think about the units, we're kind of full of FF&E furniture, fully out, move right in. Our ultimate decision was to backfill these units at market rate. So we are in the process of kind of prepping these 94 units to go to market, to be marketed as, you know, kind of truly for rent offerings. So I think one thing that's important, and part of the reason we made the decision to do so, hey Sam, how are you?
Hey, well, sorry I'm late.
No worries. We were just kind of catching up on North Loop Green. So you know, Sonder filed for bankruptcy. We are in the process of preparing the units they gave back. They gave back 94 units as part of that exercise. We're in the process of prepping those units to be leased at market rate. Part of what we looked at, the prospect of other operators, short-term rental companies stepping into that space. Our view is that from a long-term kind of tenancy profile, we like the idea of having those rented to individual users as opposed to doing another kind of enterprise-level lease.
Josh, yeah, I think, well, it's important to note that the lease we had with Sonder was more of like I'll call it a master lease structure with a guaranteed stream of payments, and most of these short-term, or I'll call it hoteling operators, operate on a revenue share model as opposed to, you know, getting into long-term master leases and then going out and doing a short-term rental. So our thought is just the best course of action is to take the units back, bring them all to market rates. We'll mention the FF&E. Obviously, all the units were furnished. We've been working with the bankruptcy court to determine the path forward there. I think we found a solution with another third party that may want to take the FF&E on some of the floors. We're also assessing keeping some of it on a couple of floors to market fully furnished units as kind of a test case. So I think the focus, you know, the beginning of this year coming through the middle of the year is to take in the market. Our projections now reflect us, I'll call it getting back to fully stabilized by, call it early to mid-summer. I think the good news here is most of these units, while on the lower part of the stack, are heavily weighted towards the studio and one-bedroom units, which we've seen quite a bit of throughput on. So obviously not great news, but in light of the circumstances, I think, you know, this is the best thing for the project, both kind of on a run rate operating standpoint and then, you know, from a future liquidity standpoint. Obviously, when you have a significant slug of your units that are, you know, leased out to either a corporate rental agency or a hoteling operator like this, there's, you know, can be some perception of a, you know, exposure here. But I think we'll get through this. Absent that, leasing at the multifamily stack has continued to perform very well. We've maintained above 90%, kind of hovering in the low to mid 90%, lease and occupied percentage, so performing very well there.
Okay. And I guess overall business plan for this asset, how does the Sonder news impact kind of liquidity projections or return projections for Northloop Grand moving forward?
Yeah, obviously a blip. It's a bit to be determined what the impact is on a kind of an, I'll call it an operating cash flow basis. That'll be predicated on, how quickly we can reabsorb the units. The intent here is to get it back stabilized, and then look to sell, either the entire project inclusive of the office or, some type of parcelized interest, potentially. That's to be determined at this point, whereby we'd sell, the multifamily separate from the office component. But that plan is still in the works there. So obviously the Sonder blowing out is not great news, but to be determined. I think you've got to balance the, I'll call it the, several month operational blip and leasing lift with, from where I sit that, the lack of, I'll call it headwinds when you go to market the multifamily component by not having 90 plus units leased to a singular, master lessee. So to be determined at this point, but I do like the prospect of having a fully market rate, traditional multifamily asset to sell through to the market. On the office side, we're hovering right at 70% leased. Obviously, our major tenant, Piper Sandler, they're moved in. Things are going well there. We did see an uptick in activity on the office leasing front at the end of the year. Have several live prospects interested in space, and I think, at least from where I sit, we've got a path to get to the mid 70s occupied, pushing above 80% occupied there. Obviously, the office environment broadly is a bit challenged. That being said, we do see very good name brands with interest in the project, good touring activity. So I'm heartened by the fact that, during the holidays, there was, good leasing, and touring velocity at the project. As far as expectations to stabilize, my sense is it's going to take just a bit to get us kind of above, I'll call it a 90% marker, just for lack of a better way of putting a precise number on stabilized occupancy, but I do feel like that there's a path to get there. And so we'll spend this year, focused on the multifamily side, getting the leasing profile of the office perfected as best we can, all while, assessing what a liquidity scenario may look like, whether that's taking everything out as one or, like I said, parcelizing it or selling a condo interest in each of the deals.
Yeah, we do have the ability to sell the office tower without the multi and vice versa. So
yeah,
that is a potential outcome as well.
All right. Well, since Sam's on, let's pivot a little bit. Let's just get an update on kind of where things sit with direct access, kind of the timing, selling syndicates, stuff like that.
Yeah, so we are, officially all docs have been finalized. We are in the market having these types of diligence conversations. I think as it relates to, thinking about a first close, we're probably thinking about June, July. We're kind of, and that's kind of a two-pronged thing. Like we're looking for that first opportunity that we think will be a great brochure-worthy investment opportunity aligned with that first close to kind of gin up a bit of enthusiasm there. But so far, so good. Really positive feedback to the concept. Feel like we're making progress. Jeff is maybe best suited to give some visibility into the other folks that are currently evaluating the offering.
Sure. Hey, guys. Hey, Sam. Good to see you, man. I made my beard jokes earlier, so I won't repeat them, but wanted to join the gang. But yeah, so obviously, clearly we've been talking to you guys for quite some time. Same boat with Cetera, and then Sean Bond's working closely with LPL Commonwealth, Osaic, a small firm DFPG actually has already signed, and then countless RIAs are looking at this from the retail side as well. But those are the big players on the independent space that we're talking to.
You plan on having any wires involved in this one or large regionals?
Will, I may pitch that one back to you. I'm not sure who all.
So there is a. I don't know if you guys have. So there are some larger RIAs that we're sharing this with. From the private banking side, I don't know that we're going to have, you know, like we've got this, we've been working on the strategic partnership with Citi. I don't know that they'd be participating on the direct access partner side. Their participation will most likely be more on the, you know, the club side of this.
They've limited quite a bit who they want us to play with in this one. And so, you know, anyone that's kind of a competitor to them is they kind of scratched off the list and sent some wires.
Okay.
So June, July 1st close, and then if I recall correctly, Will, the program runs roughly two years to from first close to kind of wrapping up fundraising. Is that right?
It's a little shorter. So it's final close will be. Doug, is it 12 months after 12 or 18?
Yeah, 12 months from first close,
yeah.
Okay. And I think your target was 200. What's kind of the minimum size that you would feel comfortable with?
It's a good question. I think probably... Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we'd have to probably set 75 as a hard floor. You know, so far there's been really strong interest, so would be mildly surprised if we didn't get there. But I think, you know, anything above that, we feel pretty good about being able to get capital deployed in an efficient manner.
Kind of financing targets, have those shifted at all since we last spoke? Some of the I think the deals we were doing last year still 60% roughly.
I mean, I would assume you know, from an asset level financing standpoint, you know, 50 to 60% loan to cost. In rare situations, we will go a little bit above that. But you know, we talk a lot about, you know, generating alpha, so you know, driving value at the real estate level. So try not to get too heavily focused on the financial engineering to make numbers work. But you know, 62.5%. Maybe 65% loan to cost, but that's usually kind of where we top out at the asset level.
Okay, and still multifamily and industrial is kind of the two buckets.
Still multifamily and industrial focused. You know, I would expect probably most of what we're going to do here is going to be ground up development, just because the predictability of timelines and whatnot. We do have the flexibility to do kind of heavy value add acquisitions, but would expect this to lean more towards ground up execution.
Sam, anything else on like selling syndicate fundraisers that you'd want to cover with these folks?
I mean, I guess just looking at those firms, like Jeff, do you have a sense what you think like Cetera, LPL, Commonwealth would each do in this thing?
Great question, and we have not gotten any firm commitments from those guys specifically, but you know, they've all participated in private placement deals with us over the years, and so you know, you've seen anywhere in that range from about 5 to 20 million, depending on the offering and the size, and so depending on how size this one is, I would imagine kind of typical same range.
Okay, and I know when we talked about some of the older offerings from Polaris, if you guys already went through this, but you did have some distributors that didn't want you to buy the assets at all. Like, is that the case here?
So that's a good question, Sam. You know, so part of what we're doing is we're kind of iterating this forward to kind of look and feel more like our other offerings. So we're going to do, quarterly valuations, an annual investor meeting, et cetera, in the portfolio. So, I think it should be in the data room, the kind of cadence of, the quarterly report and the information that will be included within,
Okay.
I guess, Will, one question. Sam and I, we chat, you know, we're taking 100-plus calls a year with firms across all space, including a lot of real estate managers, and I would say a consistent theme we've heard over the last 12, 18 months has been development's not the place to go within real estate. We can buy existing properties at better pricing, less risk involved. I guess what would you say to that comment? Because it's been across the board, I would say, from some of the larger real estate managers in the world have all kind of echoed that same sentiment.
I think if you're painting a broad brush, I think, you know, you can step back and say it's difficult to make development pencil today. I think, you know, Hines is 70-year-old you know, investment manager. We've seen a few cycles, and I would say the opportunity set is smaller than maybe it was 36 months ago, but we are, you know, our investment committee is still approving development offerings. We still see opportunities to, you know, finance deals that are, you know, at accretive leverage in markets where we feel like there are, you know, barriers to entry. So certainly wouldn't disagree with the statement that it's a more challenging environment, but, you know, there are still things that we feel are interesting right now. And, you know, it's certainly market dependent as well, right? I think, you know, over the last cycle, you saw a lot of new product delivered in the Sun Belt. The last deal we capitalized in Q4 was in suburban Chicago, which, you know, from a micro market standpoint, had not seen the same influx of supply. And, you know, kind of looking at the supply demand imbalance, there is a very, very easy story to get your arms around. So very much market and deal dependent, but wouldn't disagree with the assertion that, you know, it's harder to make development pencil today than it was, you know, 24, 36 months ago.
And then maybe a more specific doc question. I spoke with Dana and team about this, but
think we might have lost your audio.
One thing that caught my attention in reviewing the meeting. How about now? Can you hear me?
We got you. Got you back, yeah.
Just around the allocation policy.
Yeah.
Will,
yeah,
and, that's and one that, mm-hmm. It seemed like there was potential for this language around opportunities that can be capitalized one-off, so not fund-specific deals. Mm-hmm. Be curious kind of what your comments are there, because I think the concern for us is always, as a retail shop, are we getting access to the best deals, or are institutional investors, some of your larger clients, maybe getting at priority to us? So that's kind of what led me to down that path.
It's a good question that we get a lot, and I think part of it is the fact that, you know, Hines is vertically integrated, and I think our process of getting deals through allocation may be a little bit different than some other folks. So I'll walk all the way through the process and kind of give an example of, you know, how the structure is really designed to function. So every Monday we have what we call our deal support and allocation call. It's effectively a pipeline call where the regional business generators, our teams on the ground around the country, will present the live investment opportunities they're working on. To the extent there are things that we feel like would be of interest to the direct access partners investors, we're flagging those as deals we would like to track. Part of our kind of vertical integration structure is Hines steps into deals pretty early. So most of what we see, most of what we capitalize has kind of been in the Hines ecosystem for 18 plus, at least 18 months. So, you know, the opportunity I referenced in suburban Chicago, I think that was originally presented at our pipeline call probably 2.5 years ago. We're working on an opportunity in Boulder County, Colorado, that's about originally tied up about 3 years ago. So I say we flag things early and have good visibility into kind of the process that these transactions will go through before they are capitalized. So on our Monday morning pipeline call, to the extent there's something that we like, we'll raise our hand and say, hey, this is something we would like to evaluate. For acquisition opportunities, our discretionary funds, so we have two active discretionary funds, that's Hines Global Income Trust, which you guys are familiar with, and on the institutional side we have Hines US Property Partners. Both of those funds lean towards being more income focused. So, you know, what we're doing here in Direct Access Partners is, you know, truly opportunistic in profile. It's worth noting that Hines Global can do development and Husk can do development as well. But that is not the core focus of either vehicle. So for acquisitions, those strategies have a priority right in the investment allocation. For development, there is no priority structure. And part of the reason for that is the way our development deals take shape, it is rare that we are overlapping in interest. And what I mean by that is deal size, market, return profile. It's rare that we end up pursuing the same opportunity. In the rare instance that Hines U.S. Property Partners and the direct, the direct investing platform are pursuing, we flag the same deal at our pipeline call, we will underwrite it in tandem. So we will work on that deal together. And at a point in time, it kind of becomes a first come, first serve. So I'll give an example. There's a multifamily development in Greensboro, North Carolina, that we both raised our hand for. We thought it would profile well as an opportunistic play. They think it profiles well for a long-term hold. We worked on that deal in tandem for probably 9 months. They ultimately stepped up and said, hey, we're willing to commit firm capital to this. That was about 12 months before the site was shovel ready. At that point, we stood down because we did not feel as if it made sense for us to make that same commitment. So I think the way to articulate it is, we, in a scenario in which there are multiple capital sources interested in an opportunity, we underwrite it in tandem, and to the extent we get to a place where one party is willing to put a stake in the ground, the other will back off. It's kind of a first come, first serve in a scenario where both parties have identified the deal as being something they're serious about. It's pretty rare that a deal gets all the way to that level, partly because of some of the structuring we have to do on the front end, right? Everything that we present to Direct Access Partners will be shovel ready. So if there's a project that has to go through a zoning or a re-entitlement process, there's a good chance that that gets capitalized elsewhere because we don't have the ability to take on that risk. Does that make sense, guys?
I guess I would ask Will, like, you're doing a lot of development at Hines.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing that development in the two funds you called out,
correct,
the core funds. Mm-hmm. My assumption then is you're doing development off of your own balance sheet and with a lot of institutional partners that are participating alongside of you. Maybe tell me, understand, like, where are the development dollars coming from when you're doing projects at Hines?
That is correct. So a concise way to say it is the opportunity set for ground-up development at Hines far exceeds what our discretionary funds can do. And every development deal within the United States, we will see and have an opportunity to capitalize. Where we don't participate is when deals are very, very large, where the return profile doesn't match something that's brought to us by a partner, right? Outside of that, we have kind of a clear runway. So we will underwrite and evaluate, tour markets, see all of those deals with the goal of potentially putting them in the Direct Access Partners Fund.
So you called out return profiles. Are your institutional partners seeking higher return profiles than what you're seeking in this program?
I mean, I would say it's deal specific and it's opportunity specific. Right now, I would say there isn't a whole lot of competition for what we're doing right now. I think we, our cost of capital, our return profile, what we're offering to investor prospects is pretty compelling. The thing we did in Chicago last in Q4, the project we're in market with right now, there was not another capital source that showed up and tried to pull those away from us. Those were deals that we flagged early on, things we had conviction in because of the markets and the teams on the ground, and they were, allocated our way.
So if it's trying to wrap my head around this whole first come, first serve idea, I feel like the direct access is likely going to be slower to act than the other capital sources, which kind of leave direct access last in line for deals, wouldn't it?
No,
it's like, how is direct access ever going to be faster than an institutional
buyer? Wouldn't say slower to act. Yeah, I would frame it maybe differently. I wouldn't say slower to act. I would say a deal has to profile in a certain way for to be actionable for direct access partners. So, for example, I mean, I use an example of a project that might need to go through a rezoning exercise. If you have if you had a pension fund that was based, let's say CalPERS, they're based in California and they are comfortable with, you know, San Diego zoning and entitlement law. They may say, hey guys, that site you have for industrial development in suburban San Diego, we'll take the risk on, we'll jump into that early, and that's something we won't action, right? So I would reframe it as, it's not we'll be slower than, you know, another capital source. I would say maybe we're not as flexible. A deal has to fit within it has to be a certain size. It has to be a certain return profile. And we've got to be able to get it to shovel ready with the resources at hand, recognizing that we can't take some of the risks that that a large third party might be able to. Does that make sense, Sam?
Okay. Yeah, I guess it does. So what percentage of deals are you doing that don't have this rezoning risk?
So when
like, is it naturally going to be the case where shovel ready deals go to HDAP and only HDAP, and all the other investors are going to have deals that have this embedded rezoning risk?
No. So our directs platform has everything we've done through our directs platform has been de-risked. So, you know, the deals I referenced that we're in market with right now, as well as the direct access partners, those deals are presented. We flag those deals after they've been to investment committee and they've effectively received the requisite approvals for vertical capitalization. So in that example I used about the San Diego industrial, there's a chance that deal doesn't get, you know, zoned or entitled and it dies on the vine, right? We don't take that risk with our direct deals. Anything that we present to HDAP or even on our one-offs, we're presenting deals that we know have cleared those hurdles and are going vertical. And so that's what I mean by kind of like it's there's a certain subset of the opportunities we capitalize that will make its way that fit what we're doing for direct access partners. And then there are other deals that just flat out won't because of what we would call like the pre-development risk associated with the transaction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess I'm just trying to get a sense for the magnitude of deals that you guys are doing more broadly, because I see the headline numbers in terms of how much you invest, asset mm-hmm. levels and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't know is if what you're doing, the bulk of the investment activity includes deals where you're taking this rezoning risk and thus potentially, if you guys are good at it, which we think you're good at it, achieving outsized rewards for investors by taking that risk on, or if the majority of your activity would be for deals that would be quote-unquote appropriate for HDAP because they're shovel-ready. That makes sense.
So I think totally makes sense. And I think the best way we can do it is let us go back through. We can do kind of a look back at what we've flagged as deals that we want to capitalize and kind of articulate this is why XY deal didn't, you know, this is why this deal didn't make, this is why this deal was something we flagged. Generally, it's because of, you know, dollars that would be required to put at risk before we know we have a deal. Or some other stipulation. It's brought to us by a family office that, you know, has a capital source that they're going to bring alongside, or it's, you know, something that is of scale or the returns don't make. So happy to kind of walk you through that exercise so you guys can feel comfortable with the allocation. We've received this question before. Hines is a big organization and we do a lot of deals, and we want you guys to feel as if like there's a thorough understanding of, hey, this is how this deal is getting capitalized. This is how it made it to me. So happy to go through that exercise and chat through.
Yeah, and we don't think you guys are doing anything untoward, but I will tell you that we've had a number of calls where it's been presented in a way that is not entirely dissimilar from what you're presenting, where mm-hmm. it's like, well, there's a set criteria for the retail fund, mm-hmm. but then when you dig a couple layers deeper, what that actually means is that the kind of leftovers or excess deal flow is what retail investors get, where somebody else that might be a much bigger investor or, you know, can act quicker, whatever it may be, gets all of the, I guess, call it highest quality, highest returning, best deal flow. Like that's really what we're trying to get down to. And
absolutely.
It's certainly going to be more Byron's world than mine, but I don't know that I've got a good handle on how it works just yet. So it might be informative to get just a better sense in terms of like, all right, so we did all of these deals.
We'll run through kind of recent, we can look at our current pipeline and kind of historic, some of the stuff that's been capitalized recently and just kind of articulate, hey, this is where we stepped in. We were pencils down here because of, you know, zoning or entitlement risk. Part of what we ask our regional teams to provide on our, you know, Monday morning pipeline call is kind of like a front, like walk us through what it will take to get this project to shovel ready. Because in certain instances, like for example, if it's a, hey, we need to buy $25 million of land before the end of Q1 2026, and we're going to go vertical on this deal in Q1 of 2028, we're out, right? Like, we don't have this, our platform doesn't have a resource to carry land for 2 years, and there's substantial risk in kind of return deterioration over that time. So let us put some numbers on paper and kind of some logic to how this actually works, and it probably makes sense for us to kind of regroup to walk you guys through it, because fully understand the concern. We want to make sure you guys understand exactly how this works and that you're not getting, you know, leftover deals. That's not the intent of what we're doing.
Okay, great.
Yeah, we'll wait for that analysis. Jeff, I guess if you and your team can provide any details on selling Syndicate, I think that when we reconvene, that will be helpful color as well. I would say we certainly haven't seen massive pickup in real estate activity, so would be curious if maybe there's more receptivity to these strategies outside of Ameriprise, because I would say line of sight to $200 million with a Cetera, Ameriprise, and LPL within real estate might seem a little more challenging to me now than it would have 4 or 5 years ago. So that's some additional analysis that could help us in our efforts to look at this fund.
You bet. We'll get you that update.
Thanks for the time, guys.
Well, thank you. We'll
appreciate
the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
All right. Thanks,
guys. Thanks to everyone.
See you soon.